Hey, it's Glenn Washington, the host of the Snap Judgment Podcast. And at Snap, each and every week, we drop you into someone else's world. Feel what they feel. Duck when they duck. Weep when they weep. And laugh when they laugh. Surprising, cinematic, it's raw. Stories that connect us all. We go there each and every week because we found that it is hard to hate someone if you know their story. Snap Judgment, storytelling with a beat. Each and every week, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back and happy 2026. I am Sadia Khan, the host of Immigrantly. Before we get into today's episode, I want to share something we've been working on behind the scenes. Starting today, Immigrantly is launching a four-part limited series called Borderly. It's hosted by Mario Carrillo, a journalist, immigration advocate, and longtime El Paso resident. Someone who didn't just report on the border, but grew up in its shadow and understands its lived experiences. This series was created because so much of the conversation around the border has been flattened into sound bites, fear and dehumanization. Borderly does something different. It centers the people, families, organizers, and residents whose lives are shaped by the border every single day. I'll be back with new Immigrantly interviews in February. Until then, I hope you spend this month with Borderly and allow these stories to slow the narrative down, add context, and restore much needed humanity. Enjoy the series.
If you stop and stand on the Paso del Norte Bridge that connects downtown El Paso and downtown Ciudad Juarez long enough, you can feel two countries at once. For some, El Paso marks the end of the United States, while for others, El Paso is simply an extension of Mexico. But for those of us who live here or who grew up here, this edge on the map of Texas is so much more than this. It's the center of our world. A world between two cities, countries, and cultures whose history has been intertwined for centuries. This is Borderly by Immigrantly, a four-part podcast series that explores the life of people straddling two worlds. This series is for people who at times feel like they're from two countries, while at other times maybe feel like they don't belong to any place. I'm your host, Mario Carrillo, and my family migrated from Mexico when I was 4 years old, and the border, maybe unknowingly then, would shape who I am as a person and in my career. I remember crossing the border freely back when I was younger to visit my dad at his office, to visit the doctor, and yes, even maybe sometimes to party with friends before we were all 21, and honestly, not thinking much of it, but also not realizing how beautiful the border was until I left. For many of us from El Paso, leaving the city is seemingly a rite of passage, but there's a pull about the border that is undeniable, which is why I'm back home now, raising a family right here on the border. I've long felt that one thing that every single country in the world has in common is that its boundaries end at some point. And what we hope to do here at Borderly is to explore life on that edge. But for now, we'll head back to El Paso. Maybe you've never been here, or maybe even like me, you've spent most of your life here. But it's undeniable that our border is worthy of its own story being told, of the line that divides us, a line that's been fought over, misunderstood, and mythologized, but never still. Over the next four episodes, we'll explore how this line came to be, how people have lived along it, how it's been portrayed and covered by the media, and what it means to truly call the border home today. But before we talk about walls and patrols and policies, we have to go back to a time before the line existed at all. Worry not, listeners, Borderly is not a history podcast, but to understand the border today, it's important to understand the context of how we got here. Long before anyone called this place Texas or Mexico, there was a river, the Rio Bravo or the Rio Grande, and it didn't divide anything. It connected. The river was life for the indigenous peoples who lived along its banks, that fished its waters, followed its bends, and crossed it freely. It was a gathering place, not a boundary. Then by the 1600s, the Spanish had built missions, Isleta, Socorro, and San Elisario, which versions of the churches can still be visited to this day. They brought about Christianity, and with it, violence and assimilation, but they also left behind traces of a new, blended world, a place where indigenous, Spanish, and later Mexican identities would mix, giving rise to something brand new, La Frontera. And after Mexico would win its independence from Spain in 1821, its northern frontier at that point stretched all the way to what is now Wyoming. Texas and El Paso were certainly a part of that. But soon, settlers from the United States began moving into Mexican Texas, bringing with them slavery and a hunger for land. Tensions grew, and by 1836, the Texas Revolution had fully erupted. At this point, Mexico lost control of its northernmost province, but the exact boundary between that new Republic of Texas and Mexico remained unclear. Would it be the Nueces River or the Rio Grande? That dispute would soon define the fate of this region forever. And after that, with the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo in 1848, a new international line was drawn. The Rio Grande, once a gathering place, would now divide two relatively new nations. It was a line written on a map, but that cut through people's lives, families, through burial places, even through mountains. What seemed overnight, thousands of Mexicans living north of the river found themselves living in a new country, foreigners in their own land. This would be the beginning of the border as we know it today. But to better understand how that moment still echoes here in the streets of El Paso, in the memory of families who have lived here for generations, we turn to someone who has spent her life studying and preserving that history. Dr. Yolanda Chavez Leyva is a historian, an educator, and an El Paso native. Her work spans borders and decades and explores memory, migration, and the lives of people whose stories often go untold. I sat down with Dr. Leyva at the University of Texas at El Paso to talk about how this border was created and what it means to grow up being both from aquí y de allá, from here and from there. I'm here with Dr. Yolanda Chavez Leyva, an oral historian at the University of Texas at El Paso. And you are our first guest on Borderly, so it's an honor to meet you, first of all, here in person, and to get to know a little bit about the work that you've been leading now for such a long time at telling stories of our borderland. And I know that you have been collecting stories for such a long time, but for me in particular, I'm really interested in your own border story. You spent your career sharing the stories of people here, other fronterizos, but what about your own? What is your connection to our borderlands?
I love La Frontera. I love El Paso. I love Juarez. And I was born in Juarez in 1956. I was born to a very young woman, and I had an identical twin. We were born very prematurely, so we only weighed 2 pounds each. And she was very young. She was unmarried. I'm sure that she didn't know what to do, so she ended up giving my sister Elisa to her mother, and she gave me to her tía. My adoptive parents are biologically my great aunt and my great uncle. So they adopted me, brought me to El Paso. Sadly, when I look back on it, I think this is how, even as a child, I started to see what the border meant. My twin died after a month because she didn't have medical care. And when I finally found her death certificate, she had died really of drinking bad water, which in the 50s, something like 75% of households in Juarez did not have good water. And then I was brought here to El Paso. I had medical care. My parents were lower middle class. My mother devoted herself to me. And here I am 69 years later. But I think that's when I really started to know something, because I would think, and I don't know, when I was very little, I don't think I knew what Juarez was exactly, but I knew there was something different since I was a conscious little kid. Knew that I had a sister who had died over there, and I had lived over here. One of the great gifts to me, other than I survived being a 2-pound baby in 1956, was that I was raised by an older generation. And both my parents loved to tell me stories about crossing the border in the 1910s, the 1920s, the Great Depression, World War II. Their stories usually ended in the 40s, but they told me a lot of stories for those decades. And I think that's what influenced me to listen to people. I've always, since I was a little kid, listened to people. And I don't know if people are just born with a certain energy, but strangers on the street, it's all my life, come up to me and just tell me their life stories.
You have a way.
So there's something that I think that's my calling in life, is really to listen and then to share those stories.
Well, thank you so much for sharing such a personal story about your own family as well and your sister. And I'm curious what life was like for your parents from what you gathered from the stories that they told you, having crossed the border back and forth too at a different time, especially during the revolution, which was such an important time in El Paso's history in terms of like the demographics of the city as well. So I don't know how much they shared with you, but what about your own parents' story of the border?
My father was born in 1910, just a couple of months before the outbreak of the revolution. And his father and mother, who were listed as peones on an hacienda, started to follow Villa's troops. So my grandfather fought in the revolution. And my father remembers as a 3-year-old, and he remembers the battle. It was the one of the battles at Torreon, that his mother would send him out into the battlefield after the fighting was over to see if his father's body was there.
Wow.
So he remembered helping put stones on the eyes of the dead. So the fighting was just too much. They decided to come to El Paso. So they came in 1914. In 1917, there was an immigration law that made it harder to cross the border. But this was 1914. So they kind of just walked across the border. There was no immigration official. So they just crossed and started their life here in El Paso. My mother was a different deal. She came from a very educated middle-class family in Chihuahua. They were also fleeing the violence. So they came in 1921. So lots of people know about the baths here at the border, where people crossing the border had to go through. Sometimes it was kerosene, sometimes it was Cyclone B. When my mother was in her late 80s, and it was shortly before she died, she thought I was her sister. So she told me lots of things, thinking I was her sister, like, remember this, remember that. So she told me one day, remember that they didn't make us go through that bath, because they knew we were queramos gente buena. We were good people, i.e. white skin with some level of money. And I had never thought about my mother knowing about the baths, much less being so proud that they didn't have to go through them.
How did that make you feel?
Well, because I had known about the baths from research. You know, it's funny, sometimes talking to my parents, they would tell me things that I would say, oh, that's very historical. Because the way that I think many of us are raised is that our family stories are just our family stories, not that they're connected to a bigger history. And especially for Mexican Americans, where our history is still undervalued. People still try to do away with our ability to learn our history.
Not fully told, too.
And not told, yeah. It made me feel like, oh, which is a feeling I've had a lot since I started to go to the university. Oh, we are part of history.
That's so interesting, because I feel like for me, also having grown up on the border, I don't necessarily know how my own parents view their journey. I have not had the opportunity to interview them at length, but I feel like we all kind of share similar themes of those of us who grew up here. I wanted to touch upon your career trajectory because you were born in Juarez, raised in El Paso, but like many of us who are raised here, have a desire to leave and to explore places outside of El Paso and the border region. And your trajectory is fairly similar to mine, where you spent some time in Austin and some time in San Antonio and also some time in Tucson, but you always came back. Now, I am on my own journey of having just come back to the border as well. What was that like for you? And to what extent did you get a better or deeper understanding of the border having been away from it?
I think sometimes being away from your place of origin makes you appreciate that place more. So I was 19 when I left El Paso. I'm the classic story, like, get me out of here. So I went off to UT Austin. In the 70s, it was still a hippie town.
Totally. It's changed a lot now, yeah.
It has totally changed. And it's there that I started to take Chicano studies classes. And that's where I first started to see that the stories I heard at home were part of history. And I was a business major. Only because I was first gen, I have no idea back then who to talk to. Business sounded like, that sounds stable. That sounds like money.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I feel like a lot of, especially Latinos, their parents want their kids to pursue those careers that might be a little bit more lucrative.
Yeah, so I did that. I don't think I learned anything. Don't tell the
I'm sure you learned a lot. I'm sure you learned a lot.
But it was the Chicano studies courses that really kept me going and that really engaged me. That just didn't seem like a practical thing to do. So I went into graduate school in economics. And was failing because I'm also not an economist. So I was exploring, like, what am I? But in that time in graduate school, I was looking for a part-time job. So I got a job with Travis County working for services for the deaf, which was part of the social services component of the county. So I'm in this office. The majority of clients for the office in general were either Mexican-American or immigrants. And none of the social workers spoke Spanish. So they would call me in to translate. And I was horrified at the things that they would say. For example, the one that sticks to my mind, that was the one that pushed me over the edge, was it was a single mother with several children. And she was coming in to ask for assistance with rent. And so the social worker said, why can't you pay your rent? And she said, because I had to buy new clothes for the children because it's the beginning of school. And the social worker's like, no, you know, you shouldn't have to do that. You should have paid your rent.
Oh, wow.
But what are you going to do? Send the kids like with clothes that don't fit? That's right. Like 100 years ago where kids didn't go to school because they didn't have shoes. So I was very horrified by that. But then when the client left, she starts telling me about all the things she bought that weekend that were just like decorative things for her house. And I got so mad that I called her boss and I told him I would make a better social worker than her. So when an opening came, he hired me. And I think, you know, like I was saying, I've always been a pretty good listener, but that job really honed my listening skills.
And it got you started on the path that you've been on pretty much ever since.
Yeah. So I did that for 10 years.
And then from there, you went on to other cities and other places.
I came back. My parents were getting older and sure. I thought, well, I should go back. I was almost 31.
Okay.
And then I thought, well, I'm still young. I can be something else. I couldn't imagine staying in that line of work. The system is just set up to keep people suffering. So I thought, well, I'll go back to school and get a master's because I've always loved the border. I was like, border history. It just made total sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But at that point, was the history of El Paso something that you were already interested in or something that you had done a lot of research on? Or was it still something that was relatively new?
It was relatively new. So I came here for a master's degree.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then you left again. What do you think it is about El Paso and the border region in general that
has a way of bringing us back to where we come from.
And I see it generation after generation. Like, I'm almost 70 and I did that, right? And people still do it. And I talk to my former students in their 20s, and then they come back by the time they're 30. I think it's, I think everybody wants to be connected to their roots, but somehow we have a really strong desire to reconnect with our roots.
And when you told people where you were from, what was generally people's understanding, even back then, of what El Paso was versus what it actually was for you? Because I think even today, when I'm traveling or I get the chance to tell people where I'm from, there are so many myths and misconceptions of what it is to both grow up here and live here. So what was that like for you, of having to tell people I'm from El Paso and this is what it's actually like?
When I first moved to Austin, I was very involved in Chicano movement activities. So what the Chicano and Chicana students would tell me is, you're a real Mexican. So I was under a lot of pressure to be authentic. But that used to make me laugh because, like, this is really, really Mexico, they would say.
It feels so disconnected from the rest of Texas, right? Like El Paso does.
It's totally disconnected. Earlier this year, maybe it was last year, I gave a talk to a group of people from the Irish consulate to Texas. And I was telling him the history. And then afterwards, he says, you never mentioned Texas in that whole talk. And I was like, oh, I didn't. And it's because we are very disconnected.
Yeah, no, I think that's so true. And I've experienced that myself when we meet other Texans. They kind of see us as almost part of New Mexico or even just a part of Mexico. And then in 1978, as I understand it, is when you began documenting stories of the border. And you said that people's history is an integral part of their existence. And without recognition of their history, they cannot see themselves in the proper context. Knowing our history enables us to see where we have been and where we are now. Now, with that in mind, you know, being in 1978, what is that story of El Paso and Juarez now? And how would you define this moment that we're in today as a border region?
The moment that we're in right now, which is a very historic moment, it's a moment full of government policies that are intended to be cruel. I learned just recently that El Paso has the highest number of courthouse detentions than any other city in the United States other than New York City. And to me, the mainstream media doesn't report those kinds of things. So unless you're very well informed, you don't even know what's happening here, that kind of cruelty. So I'm saying it's historic, but it's also something that has happened to us before. So the thing that I see about El Paso is that we are a very kind community, a very generous community.
Very welcoming, I would
say. Very welcoming community. So I used to do a lot of research on the Great Depression. And I remember reading a newspaper article about the young men that were riding the trains. So they called them in the article the bums riding the trains, right? The hobos riding the trains.
It was a different time.
Right. So what they said was that there was a language that was developed among the hobos where at the train stops, they would do something like graffiti that would be different messages like, be careful in this city. But for El Paso, what they put was, this is a great city. People will give you food. It's a very kind place. And that was the white hobos in the 30s. And I think that it's because we're a poor city. And I think it's that understanding that many of us struggle economically that makes us a generous city. I was 5 miles from the border growing up, and people would come and ask us for food. Like, they would go door to door asking for food. When I moved to Austin, I was always expecting that. And it was so shocking to me that that doesn't happen in other cities. And my neighbors would always fix sandwiches or give them cans of food or whatever they could spare. So to me, El Paso is a very generous place. And that's something I wish people would know. We have a lot of empathy for people.
Certainly my experience, as well as being someone who was born in Chihuahua and raised here, I'd always felt as part of the community, even though I wasn't born here, and it welcomed our family more than 35 years ago at this point. And it's very much a part of our story of how welcoming El Paso is. To that note, though, I feel, and I'm curious what you think as well, so much of what is understood about El Paso today is viewed through the lens of migration and what's generally happening along the border in terms of folks trying to get into the country and then efforts of trying to keep people out, especially here in El Paso, South Texas. We've seen it all over the border now. How can we tell a broader, more fuller picture of what El Paso is that doesn't focus solely on what the media normally covers on it? Because I feel like if you don't know El Paso well, you would think that it's a small, tiny town that is primarily a point of crossing for folks, but it's so much more than that. So how can we tell a fuller story of what's happening here?
That's a great question. So we're a medium-sized city. People do think we're a very tiny city with tumbleweeds and roads that are not paved.
Some wicked dust storms, though. That is true. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. The thing about El Paso that I wish people would know is the creativity that is here. The art movement that is here. The murals in El Paso are amazing. So the first mural in El Segundo Barrio, which is the, you know, primary immigrant barrio historically, was painted 50 years ago this year. So that mural movement started half a century ago. And what I've really seen in the past decade is it's just flourishing. And in Juarez too, Juarez has more murals than we do. They work very collectively. There's lots of artist collectives over there. I wish people would know that we create beauty and that it's not just about militarization and suffering, even though I keep talking about suffering.
No, it's a part of it too.
Yeah.
And to your point about Juarez, there's no denying that the two cities are just completely intertwined and connected. And it almost feels that over the last 20 years or so, especially in a post 9/11 world, that connection has been severely severed. But when you think about Juarez and El Paso as a whole, obviously the impact that Spanish colonial history had on both cities is heavily felt still to this day. What would you say is that impact that Spanish colonial history had on the formation of both cities?
El Paso, Texas came out of El Paso del Norte, which is now Juarez, right. Chihuahua.
And I feel like a lot of people don't know that.
Right. So people think that we were just always here in the United States. But no, the bulk of the settlement after the Spanish came in the 1650s was in Juarez, with the building of the mission, Christianized the Manso people. So people don't know that there have been people living here for over 10,000 years, that corn has been grown here for over 4,000 years. The descendants of those people are still here.
Sure.
So that's a very invisibilized history. So with colonization, you have the founding of Juarez, with some people living here on the north side of the border, and the river keeps moving. So sometimes the same town is in the Juarez side, and sometimes it's on this side. But what I see that is still very evident in El Paso is that we love conquistadores.
We have a high school. The mascot is the conquistadores.
The conquistadores, right.
At Del Valle, sure.
Right. We have Coronado High School. We have the equestrian statue at the airport, which is really Oñate, even though they changed the name just to placate the protesters.
Yeah, no, that's true. I hadn't really thought of it that way. Is that that's probably a fairly touchy subject for a lot of El Pasoans, of wanting to recognize the history. But then I feel like a lot of folks also embrace that colonial history that we have as well.
Yeah, that's true. And the city of El Paso, the city council gives out the Conquistador Award when they want to honor somebody. It's very touchy. In 2006, when the statue was being created and then it was put at the airport in 2007, I was one of the people leading the protests, along with people from Acoma Pueblo. And people that I had been friendly with in the community as a historian got so mad at me, they stopped talking to me, and they told me that I was going against their history.
Wow.
Because Oñate was Mexicano, they were saying, so I was against our history.
When was that?
2007.
Okay. So this predates the fight over Civil War monuments that we've seen in a lot of the country, especially after 2020. So you were already fighting that fight.
Yeah, yeah. And people in New Mexico were already fighting it to try to get rid of Oñate statues there. So we have this very convoluted relationship. I know what it is. It's that our history is not told, right? We don't learn our history. So we are so hungry for anything that represents, quote unquote, our history, that something like a conquistador seems like validation,
right,
that we have a history.
No, that's interesting. And that's something that I had not thought about much in terms of having grown up here and that connection that folks might have to Spanish colonial history and their attachment to it. That's something that I feel like we should explore a little bit more. Thinking back a little bit further, maybe late 1800s, post-Civil War, we've passed, Texas was its own country for a while, and now it's a part of the United States. But what are some key moments in the late 1800s, early 1900s that you can point to that really set the scene for where we are now as a city and as a border region?
So the end of the U.S. war against Mexico, the fighting ended in 1847. The treaty was signed in 1848. Mexico lost half its land. The U.S. became twice as big. In 1850, El Paso County was created. So it wasn't until 1850 that we were really, really part of Texas. We were always part of New Mexico or Chihuahua, back and forth. So 1850 is a really key moment. And the next key moment is when the railroads arrived. 1882, because the railroads bring a lot of people from other parts of the United States.
And other parts of the world as well.
Yeah, yeah. So the demographics change. El Paso, Texas has always had a majority Mexican-American population, except for 1890, when the railroads had just come. The only time that non-Mexicans were the majority.
Who made up that demographic?
It was a lot of people from the Midwest that were coming, and I'm not sure why, but Kentucky was a really big sender of people here. So a lot of the early white pioneers were Kentuckians.
And I'd have to imagine much of their family remains in the region even today.
Yeah.
Almost 200 years later.
So the other thing that I think is important that people may not think about in the 1800s is that as white men, white businessmen were coming, and they saw this as an opportunity to make wealth, they married into elite Mexican families.
Mm.
And it was through that connection that they gained their wealth. Like you think about Hart's Mill with Simeon Hart. He married into the Siqueiros family from Chihuahua. That's how he learned to run a mill. Or Hugh Stevenson, who married Maria Azcárate, that our lake is named after.
Of course, in the park.
And, yeah. So a lot of intermarriage. And then the next generation, it's so interesting to me. So you have the next generation who are Mexican and white. A lot of them become Confederates and Confederate supporters.
That is very interesting because it's a history that I'm not even aware of, that there were Mexican folks here that were still fighting for the Confederacy. Because I mean, I understand that a lot of the reason that the United States tried to take Texas at that point from Mexico was to contain slavery here and also bring it here, whereas Mexico was in the process of abolishing it as a practice. But I didn't know that's part of the story, that even some Mexicans fought for the Confederacy. Maybe touching on the revolution the Mexican Revolution, that is, and the impact that it had on the city. There's so much lore behind it here and the impact and Pancho Villa and fighting in the north and crossing over to El Paso, the meeting here in El Paso that happened as well. That's a big part of our story. After we talk about that, maybe touching on the Bracero program too and the impact that that had on our city as well.
Despite what San Antonio and Los Angeles say, we are the most important U.S. city when it comes to the Mexican Revolution.
Yes, I agree.
We're right here on the border. So one of the most important battles in the Revolution is La Batalla de Juarez on May 11th, 1911, when the dictator Porfirio Díaz was finally kicked out and exiled to France. So that was right there in Juarez. Because we're right on the border, going back to the 1890s, you had people who opposed Porfirio Díaz hiding out in El Paso. And throughout the revolution, you had people hiding out in El Paso. So the Flores Magón brothers, the great intellectuals of Mexico in the 1890s, they were hiding out here. Teresita Orrea, who was a healer. And at 19, Porfirio Díaz said she was the most dangerous girl in Mexico. At 19. And so she and her father came to El Paso to escape being killed by Porfirio Díaz. So this has always been a refuge for political movements. And because Juarez was experiencing so many battles, their buildings were destroyed. But our buildings that are tied to the revolution are still here. So you have what they call the Villa Stash House in Barrio Duranguito, where his brother, Villa's brother, Hipólito Villa, was hiding money and arms and ammunition. Buildings downtown where Madero had his headquarters. It's really amazing. But I think the biggest effect of the revolution was it brought so many Mexicanos here. So lots of people traced their family here because of the revolution.
It really changed the demographics again of the city, and it probably became even much more so heavily Mexican at that point, right?
It did. It grew, and it grew in terms of Mexicans being here, which affected so many things. Employers were happy because they had a large workforce that they could pay very little. The schools didn't know what to do, because now they had a huge population of Mexican children, both immigrant and U.S. born. So the school district during the revolution, that's when you really start to see the disparities in education between white students and Mexican-American students.
Which one could argue exists even today among the school districts.
It does exist still today. So back then, there were what were called the Mexican schools, which were south of the railroad tracks, we would say now south of I-10.
Right.
And the American schools that were north, they were better funded. They had more experienced teachers. They had better facilities. Meanwhile, in the Mexican schools on the south side, they were so crowded that instead of building more schools, the school district divided their school day in half. So children would get half a day education instead of in the American schools, where they would get the full day.
And these were primarily children of immigrants who had fled the revolution or for one reason or another.
Right,
had ended
or been
up.
Recruited.
And now thinking, I feel like there's a link in there too in terms of people ending up in El Paso. When you look at different inflection points in our history, the Bracero program is obviously a major one, and it's one that you've researched thoroughly and heard a lot of stories about. What is the connection? I know that there's even a museum in Socorro about the conditions that people were subjected to during the Bracero program, but how can we make sure that that's a history that is better understood as part of El Paso's history too?
We're so important to the Bracero program. The very first Braceros that entered the U.S. in August of 1942 entered through El Paso. But the Mexican government didn't want Braceros in Texas because Texas was so racist and violent. So they actually had in the binational agreement no Braceros in Texas. So they came into El Paso and then they were quickly whisked off to other states to work. So
primarily California, I imagine, maybe?
California, but also Colorado for the sugar beets. But it was the Southwest at first. Maybe 5 years later, they started to allow Braceros to be here. So when it started in 1942 to when it ended in 1964, there were almost 5 million contracts given out. So that's not 5 million men, though. It's because the contracts lasted 6 months. So a man, if he stayed in the program, would have multiple contracts. I've talked to men who were in it for years, and I've talked to men who came one time and were like, that's it, I'm not coming back.
Yeah, I can't imagine what kind of treatment they might have been subjected to. And even upon arrival, I mean, I've learned a lot about the history in terms of the cleansing that you mentioned earlier of people using all sorts of chemicals to clean. And that was especially prevalent during the Bracero program. Is that right?
It was. So the men really had a very hard time starting with the Mexican side. So the Bracero program was looking for young men with agricultural experience. So they're coming from rural areas, from tiny little villages, and then they have to go to places like Ciudad Chihuahua. That's where the processing is. And they're joining hundreds and hundreds of other men. They put their name on a list. If they don't hear their name called, too bad. They have to sign up again. So they're in places like Chihuahua with nothing. They don't have anything. So there's stories of men eating newspaper, cardboard, eating grass just to feel full, because that was days that they were waiting on the streets of Chihuahua.
And they were so reliant on hopefully getting work north of the border, and it wouldn't come for some people. But even then, it's such an interesting dynamic, because I'm sure a lot of folks who ended up in the program probably came back and told people, like, you don't even want to do that. But it was still a way out for a lot of people.
It was, because they're coming from places with no income at all. And I always remember one señor, Felipe Serrano, que en paz descanse, he died a few years ago. So I was kind of running out of questions to ask him, and I thought, I'm going to ask him about food. Uh-huh. So I told him, when you came here, what did you think of the food? And I expected him to say, oh, my mother's food was so much better. So then he said, well, when I got here, they gave me a bologna sandwich, which everyone talks about, the bologna sandwiches. And then he said, it was the most delicious thing I ever ate. And I was like, what? That's not what I expected. And it's because he never had meat. So then he thought the bologna was so delicious.
That is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And as you heard the stories of the men who were in the program, to what extent were you able to get a common thread in a lot of them, or common themes that you noticed?
To me, it's very amazing, because they all talk about a certain level of humiliation, having to disrobe and be naked in front of a bunch of strangers, being sprayed with DDT. I had seen the very famous photos of the Bracero being sprayed in the face with DDT, but I didn't understand what that really was. Then one Bracero started to tell me that they picked up their hair and sprayed in their hair, in their face, but he said the most humiliating part was that they would spray their genitals and then make them bend over and spray behind. So they all talk about that, even if they don't remember like details, because a lot of the men that we've been talking to lately are 90, and they may not remember all the details, but everybody, without exception, talks about el polvo blanco. But the thing that I see that goes throughout, which to me is very amazing, is on the one hand, they talk about the humiliation. But at the end of every interview, they say, but thank God that I was able to be here, because then I brought my family here and now they have opportunity. They all say that. It's like they have a script.
But it honestly feels a tale as old as time, that you have migrants from the world over now, especially. The patterns have changed dramatically over the last 20 years in terms of folks and coming into the country here. And you see some of the things that they're subjected to. But many of them would likely still make that move because of lack of opportunities in their country. I feel that, especially for Juarez, its proximity to the U.S. has always been something that has lured people or invited people to come, maybe with the expectation that they might cross the border, or at least an expectation of a job in a maquila more recently. How has that changed, if at all, over the last 20, 25 years that thinking of Juarez and its proximity to the U.S. kind of being more of a hindrance?
I think that up until the last 10 years, that was still very much the the idea that you come to Juarez and eventually you could cross to El Paso. But now that we've had this great migration, you know, starting with Central America and then South America and then Africa and right. Russia, and I think that's really changed things. And then I think about El Paso, our history, we've always been a laboratory for immigration policy.
And cruelty, I would say.
And cruelty. So you think about Operation Hold the Line that pushed people into the desert, into the Sonoran Desert.
That began when Bowie High School, right, was having a lot of folks trying to cross through near where the high school is even today. I remember listening to that story as well. But can you elaborate on what Operation Hold the Line was too?
So that was an operation started here in the El Paso sector by the border chief of this sector, which is not just El Paso, it's much bigger, where he was stationing border patrol officers in vehicles facing the border, and they were within sight of each other. So they were just staring at the border. In the 90s, I wrote an op-ed against it, and I was always told by the news service who published it. And I was shocked to find out that the border patrol, it's kind of a union, but they can't really unionize, had published it in their newsletter. And I was like, well, that's very bizarre. They hated that operation, too. They felt like it was giving them mental health problems just to sit there literally their whole shift staring. So that was then adopted by other places. So California had it, for example.
And does that predate the construction of what we now see here as we're driving even near UTEP, the massive barrier, the massive wall that extends way west and way east?
It does predate what we see now.
Right.
But there's always been some kind of little fence. My students in 2014 were doing research for a museum exhibit, and they discovered that the border was hardening, not just through the laws, but the fence, the material that the fences were made of, was hardening.
As we think ahead, what's happened over the last 5-10 years politically in the city, does it worry you that El Pasoans, to an extent, might be losing some of that welcoming spirit, both because of rhetoric that we've seen from the right, both of because of what might be the perceived conditions on the border? I think for me, one of the saddest things that I've experienced as being someone from El Paso is after the Walmart shooting that was clearly motivated by racism and anti-Latino sentiment, that did not seem to resonate in the same way as it did for me, for a lot of other El Pasoans. Maybe they didn't feel personally attacked. So I just worry that the conditions that have been created now over the last 5 or 10 years have made everything to the point that it's so political, and that I really worry that El Paso will be losing something that it's earned over centuries now, of being a place where people connect instead of it being a place that divides us further. Does that worry you at all?
That does worry me. I've had students that are Mexican-American students who are very anti-immigrant, even though their parents immigrated.
Sure.
And I think it's a reflection of how threatened our community is. Because you see it in the 1930s as well, where suddenly everybody is like, I'm not them. And with the media right now and this message constantly being pushed on social media, on everything, you know, about how horrible immigrants are, criminals, nobody wants to be part of that. So it does worry me. And I think it's part of not knowing our history.
Dr. Chavez Leyva, I want to thank you so much for your time. It's been such an incredible conversation for me, and I'm just wondering if you had any final thoughts that you would love to get out on our initial podcast here episode.
So first, I want to tell you that it's a privilege to be your first person on the podcast. Thank you for that.
No, thank you.
And the thing that I hope people take away from this is that we're all humans. The political divisions that are made, Mexico, the United States, we're still human. And I want people to know that El Paso despite the cruelty that happens here from government policies, I hope we continue to be a generous place and a creative place.
I hope so too. Thank you so much, Doctor. Appreciate your
time. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Dr. Leyva at the University of Texas at El Paso. I sincerely hope that you've enjoyed our conversation, and I want to send a deep, deep thanks to Dr. Leyva for taking the time to sit with me and share a bit about her own personal story and her personal connection to the border region, but also some of the stories that she's been able to capture over her long and illustrious career. And if you did enjoy, would love a review or any feedback that you might have for future episodes of Borderly. I think for me, when I thought of this project, it's something that came to me after I had moved back to El Paso with my family, after not having lived here permanently for more than 20 years and seeing how much the city has changed over that time, but frankly also how much has remained the same. And I was hoping to capture these stories in an effort to show a light on a region that is often misunderstood, misinterpreted, maybe not fully covered by the media. And I hope these stories do it justice, and they show just how beautiful our border is, how richly textured it is, and why these stories are worth telling. This was Borderly, a project of Immigrantly, hosted by me, Mario Carrillo, and produced by Sadia Han, editorial review by Shay Yu, sound design, theme music, and editing by Lou Raskin, and other music by Epidemic Sound. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.